I sure do enjoy hearing the saints singing hymns. There are so many churches you can go into these days and hear music and hear pop songs. And I think that's okay, and I think it has its place, and I'm not disavowing it wholesale or anything. But I sure do like hearing the saints of God singing the classic hymns of God and singing praises to God. But let me make something as precise and clear as I can make it. There was a girl who visited here a couple years ago, and she would always come in late. And when I asked her one time, you know, why do you always show up right around 11, right around the time when the preaching's about to start? She said, well, I don't care for the music. I don't care for that style of music, that kind of music. It's kind of old-timey, and it just doesn't really appeal to me. And I said to her, it's not for you. We're not all gathered in this room with the goal of entertaining you. There's only one audience. When the saints of God are singing or praying or praising or worshiping, We're here praising and worshiping God, and He's the audience. And my prayer is that He is satisfied and happy with what we're doing here, and that somehow He is getting glory for Himself out of the faulty efforts of people like us. Sinners saved by grace, the redeemed of God coming into a building and singing the songs of the redeemed. And I just hope that somehow He's getting glory for Himself from it. But for those of you who are a little reticent to sing, and I know some of you are, if you do sing, you sing kind of quietly. You kind of keep it to yourself in the hope that the person sitting next to you won't be able to hear you singing. And so there are some folks who kind of get the holy, holy, holy version. You're not singing to the person next to you. You're singing to God. And fortunately, David wrote in the Psalms that when we bring our praise to God, the only requirement is that we make a joyful noise. And some of you in your singing, I think, qualify as joyful noise. So be joyful about it, make your noise, and sing out, and enjoy it. Yeah, so I enjoy that. The end of March. Easter is early this year. And so our homecoming weekend is early this year. It's coming right up on us. There are folk who are coming in again from around the world. Our visitor from England last year is making all the plans necessary to be here again this year for homecoming weekend. And of course, the folks who these days are kind of the regulars, but we have people coming from Texas and Pennsylvania and California, and they're all coming in here for that weekend. We have already secured the Smyrna Assembly Hall for our meetings on Saturday and Sunday. And very good news, it looked for a while like perhaps your mom, Bertrill, wasn't going to be able to cook for us because she had a previous obligation for a wedding, a family wedding. And so Tom and I were scurrying around trying to find some alternative plan, some restaurant, some caterer, some something. And then 2 weeks ago, Bertrill called me and said, I don't know what calendar I was looking at, but I'm available homecoming weekend. And I was like, woohoo, score. So that's great. We'll be able to eat here in the building, and lots of good things are happening. So what we're planning this year, this is why I'm saying this to you in the room and to the folks on the internet, what we're planning this year is that rather than have a guest speaker as we've done in the past on Saturdays, we've decided that since this is the GCA homecoming, we're going to keep it in-house this year. And the teaching and preaching on Saturday is going to be done by the GCA deacons, who do a very good job of rotating and teaching here in my absence. And so they're actually at this moment kind of flipping coins and arm wrestling for what order they're going to be in and who's going to do the teaching and preaching. There will be two of them that will do the teaching. I've given them about a half hour apiece, which is like tying a rope around Alex, but, you know, that's what we're shooting for. And then one of them are going to do the hosting duties. So Saturday is going to be a GCA Deacon Day, which we've simply never done, but I'm so proud of our deacons and so happy with the work that they do that I want the folks who come in from all around to also get to know these men because they hear them on our website. They hear them doing the teaching and preaching in my absence. But then as soon as I put that forward and said, you know, we'll have the deacons do the teaching, immediately there was the Barney Johnson backlash. Because last year when we had a guest preacher who was not Barney Johnson, people came up to me and said, what happened to Barney? What did he do wrong? And so Barney Johnson's going to be here Sunday, February 17th. And so he'll be here preaching for us that day. So make sure that you come and hear Barney on that day. Mid-March is the Embracing the Truth Conference here in Gladeville, Tennessee. Very close, an easy drive from here. It's going to be starting on a Tuesday night and then all day Wednesday, all day Thursday, all day Friday. Haven't seen the final schedule yet, but they've contacted me to say that I'm in the teaching schedule again this year. So I'll be doing some lecturing at some point. That's preaching and lecturing. That will be bringing David Morris to town. So since he'll be in town for that conference mid-March, we've already conspired, and he's going to be here on the Sunday morning prior to the conference in mid-March. So mid-February, we're going to have Barney Johnson here. Mid-March, David Morris here. The conference in Gladeville that week, where you're going to have opportunity to hear many, many good preachers, and then homecoming weekend at the end of March. So the next 2 months, there's plenty of things going on around here, so plan accordingly. Okay? Turn to Hebrews 11. Last week, after I had talked at some great length about the land promise, and how the land promise is central to understanding Hebrews 11. When we got done, one of the folks here at the church, one of the fellas, asked me why the emphasis and the concentration on the land promise. And he said, is it essentially because of the kind of one-for-one relationship where if God doesn't keep his promises to Israel, we can't count on him to keep his promises to us? Is that really why you're driving this and why you're emphasizing this? And that is part of it. Certainly, I have said over and over again, it's an essential part of the overall biblical theology that if God does not keep every promise he ever made to any particular person or any group of people, then we certainly can't have any confidence that he's going to keep his promise to us. If you can find even one example in the Bible of God making a promise to some specific person or specific group, and then God just saying, never mind, for some reason I've changed my mind, well then we can't really have any confidence. Where are you going to place your confidence when you have a God who's capricious like that and who will just change his mind? Especially if he's likely to change his mind based on your behavior. Then you're really in trouble. What you want is a God who is faithful to his own word, regardless of the activity of people. Because there's nobody in this room who, if God predicated the relationship on you, could walk out of here with any confidence. Because we'd all walk out going, oh no. And I grew up in that. I grew up in the religion of performance, and had that constant fear that at some point I was going to do whatever it was that would make God give up on me, because the theology that I was taught was that God would graciously accept you if you chose him, but then you could also lose your salvation, and you could do that either through willing rebellion, or you could lose your salvation just by failure to hang on tight. Failure to keep showing up in church, the failure to continue to do the actions and activities that the church prescribed, you could lose your salvation. So I spent most of my youth up into my early 20s in the constant fear that at any moment I was going to do something horribly wrong and God was just going to say, well, then never mind. And that scared me. I never had any confidence at all. So yes, the reason that I emphasize the land promise is because I'm emphasizing the faithfulness of God to his people under all circumstances. And if God can be faithful to promises he made to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, despite the rebellion of all the later generations of Israel, if God is still faithful anyway under those circumstances to a stiff-necked, hard-hearted, rebellious, backbiting people who chased after their foreign gods and who broke his law over and over again, and with every rule and every precept that he laid down, they were quick to break those rules. If God would still be faithful to them, then I have hope. Then I know that that God's going to be faithful to me. So yes, that's part of why I emphasize the land promise. However, to look at the Bible in its broadest context, you also have to read it in its historic context. And in the first century, when this letter was being penned by a Hebrew to Israelites, the land promise was foremost on their mind. My evidence is Things like when Jesus was ready to leave the planet at the beginning of the book of Acts, we read that for 40 days he spoke to his apostles, who he revealed himself to, and for 40 days he taught them about the kingdom. That was the specific topic that's mentioned. You don't see anything else mentioned there. In that passage, it doesn't say for 40 days they talked about salvation and redemption and substitutionary atonement. And you don't see any of that. It says for 40 days talked about the kingdom. And after 40 days of talking about it, their perception of what Jesus was saying was that the kingdom still belonged to Israel and that it was still a physical kingdom and that at some point there was going to be a restoration of Israel and Israel was going to have their kingdom. Because the question they asked him is, will you at this time restore the kingdom to Israel? So after Jesus' coming, 3.5 years of ministry, his death, his burial, his resurrection, 40 days of talking about the kingdom, they still wanted to know, okay, well, is that now? Are you going to do that now? And his answer, since it was a time question, will you at this time restore the kingdom? His answer was a time answer. He said, it's not for you to know the times, the seasons that God keeps in his own hands. In other words, no, not yet. But what he did not say was, well, see, guys, you don't understand. It's now an allegorized kingdom. It now belongs to the church, or it now belongs to the Gentile nations. Instead, they asked him a physical reality. Are you going to restore the kingdom to Israel at this time? And his answer was, not yet. Well, that fits perfectly with what we're reading in the book of Hebrews. Because the writer of Hebrews has been going through the list of various Old Testament saints who have the promise. That promise that they're going to get the land. It's even referred to as the land of promise. And Abraham and Isaac and Jacob all dwelt in tents in the land of promise, but they dwelt there as strangers and pilgrims. So even though they had the promise that they would inherit and that they would live in this land continually, safely, even though they had that promise, the writer of Hebrews says these all died not having obtained the promise. And at the end of the chapter, sums it up with, the reason they didn't get it is because God had something better in mind so that they without us would not be completed or perfected. In other words, it's going to be a group thing, which is exactly what all of the prophets of Israel had always said. It's going to be all 12 tribes of Israel. It's going to be a group thing. So when you look at it in its historic context, you realize that that first century of Hebrews, the first century of Israelites, the one thing they were just really anticipating and waiting for, the only thing they had not yet received, was that land promise. They were living under the yoke of Rome at the time. And their history had been living under the yoke of the Assyrians and being under the Egyptians and then being under the Babylonians. And then when the Medo-Persians conquered the Babylonians, they were still in captivity there. Then, of course, it was Cyrus, the Persian king, who allowed them to go back and rebuild the temple, but that was just the southern tribes, and the northern tribes remained in that scattered state. And then, of course, Alexander comes sweeping across Europe and the Middle East, and so then they're under the hand of Greece and the Grecian Empire, and then Rome comes steaming in, and Jesus is on the planet at that moment. So the one thing they have not seen ever is this kingdom they keep being promised. But they've been under the hand of many other kingdoms and many other kings and many other empires, but they've never had their own kingdom. And yet, as I've said so many times, it probably sounds redundant for me to say it, but all of the Old Testament prophets speak with one voice. They all say the same thing, which is that God is going to gather the 12 tribes, give them that land, establish that kingdom. David's going to be their prince. Christ is going to rule over them, which is why when Jesus was on the planet, they expected him to bring about the kingdom. And they tried to make him king on a couple of occasions, which he resisted because he didn't come in his first incarnation in order to accomplish and set up the kingdom. He came to die in order to redeem his people. He's coming back to establish the kingdom. So the big answer is, Yes, I'm really emphasizing the land promise for a couple of reasons. Number one, because God is faithful. His faithfulness is exhibited in his faithfulness to Israel. He's going to keep every promise he ever made to Israel. Therefore, he's going to keep every promise he made to you. That's the big theological reason for emphasizing it. But the textual biblical reason for emphasizing it is because the Bible authors keep emphasizing it. And in chapter 11 of Hebrews, this is the primary point. This is the thread that's woven all the way through chapter 11. It starts with the promise. In the middle, we read, these all died not having obtained the promise. Then now he's going to name a bunch of other people, and then he's going to say, and they died without receiving the promise. And the only promise referenced anywhere in the text is the land of promise. The other promises, as I said last week, any other promise you can name was accomplished. Part of the Abrahamic covenant was, through your seed, all the nations of the earth are going to be blessed. Paul, writing to the Galatians, says that seed is Christ, and certainly now as the Gentiles and the nations are being brought into the church, we see the fulfillment of that promise. When you look in the book of Revelation, the church is described as people of every kindred, tribe, tongue, and nation. In other words, all the families of the earth are being blessed through the finished work of Christ. Okay, so that promise, we can say that's accomplished. What's the promise that's not accomplished? The land promise. So that's the reason for continuing to emphasize the land promise, to prove God's faithfulness to his people, to not adhere to any theology that feels it's necessary to explain away God's activity, but rather stand on God's word in faith and say, well, he said it, so he's going to do it. But also to put the emphasis the same place that the author put the emphasis, which is God, because he has made this promise, and that promise has not yet been accomplished, God has also given all these people faith, and they have all looked forward in faith to the promise yet to come. And so that establishes a principle, and I pointed the principle out last week, which is God purposefully puts us in situations in life that require faith. And then, amazingly, gives us the faith. You know, in Ephesians 2, 8 and 9, we read that by grace you are saved through faith, and that not of yourself. It is a gift of God, not of works, lest any man should boast. So Paul writes that faith is a gift. And then we're going to get to Hebrews 12 and read that Jesus is the author and finisher of faith. So faith is a gift. And in God's remarkable, gracious plan for his people, he puts us in situations that require faith to get through them. Then he grants us the faith to get through it in looking toward Christ in the midst of that situation that requires faith. Our faith and our dependence on God is built up. And then when we reach heaven, he gives us righteousness in exchange for the faith. And that's what Paul emphasizes in Galatians when he talks about the fact that Abraham believed God and it was counted to him for righteousness. And that takes us all the way back to the beginning of Genesis when God first made the promise of an heir and all the seed being a blessing, all the families of the earth being blessed. Abraham believed God. And you read it all the way back in Genesis, and God accounted that to him as righteousness. So that equation, that great, magnificent trade of faith for righteousness is introduced at the beginning of the book, at the beginning of Genesis, very early on. And then you get to chapter 11 of the book of Hebrews, and the writer of Hebrews explains to us that God very purposefully has taken Israel through a succession of generation after generation after generation after generation who are all carrying a promise that none of them have gotten so that they would have to live by faith. And that's the way God is. That's the character of God. That's how God operates. So the next time you find yourself in a situation where you're asking, I don't know how I'm going to get through this. What is this, God? What's this about? You're sovereign. You're in charge. You could have kept this from me. We could have avoided this. I ask that question a lot. I go to God frequently and go, okay, what is this about? Because I assume he knows what it's about. This is his plan. This is what he's working out in and through my life. And invariably, whatever it is, it requires faith. It requires me to depend on him more than I depend on myself. It requires me to stand on God's word and count it as more true than my circumstances. It requires faith. But the good news is, God is going to take that faith, which he has given me as a gift, and which he has perfected by taking me through these fiery trials, so that he can perfect my faith like taking the dross off the silver until there's pure silver left over. He's doing all that on purpose, and then he's going to trade that faith that he gave me and that he perfected and that he designed, and he's going to trade that faith for righteousness, and I'm going to be accepted forever in the court of heaven on the basis of Christ's righteousness imputed to me in exchange for faith. And that's what we're reading about in Hebrews 11, and that's why I emphasize the land promise. Long answer, short question. Yes, ma'am.
Which is all a part of a broader plan of God for the rest, for making right what happened in the Garden of Eden, that a land will be, the earth will be a restitution of all things.
There will be a restitution of all things ultimately. New heavens, new earth, new Jerusalem, all of that. Ultimately, it's all going to come together the way that God designed it. Yeah, exactly right. Hebrews 11, we got as far as verse 17 last week. So I'm going to read the first 17 verses without comment, I said with minimal confidence. Just so that we can build up speed so that when we hit verse 17, we'll understand how it fits in the big context. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for and the conviction of things not seen. For by it, by faith, the men of old gained approval. By faith, we understand that the worlds were prepared by the word of God, so that what is seen is not made out of things which are visible. By faith, Abel offered to God a better sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained the testimony that he was righteous, God testifying about his gifts, and through faith, though he is dead, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he would not see death, and he was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God, and without faith, it is impossible to please God. For he who comes to God must believe that he is, and that he is a rewarder of those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God about things not yet seen, in reverence prepared an ark for the salvation of his household, by which he condemned the world, and became an heir of the righteousness which is according to faith. By faith, Abraham, when he was called, obeyed by going out to a place which he was to receive for an inheritance. And he went out, not knowing where he was going. By faith, he lived as an alien in the land of promise, as in a foreign land, dwelling in tents with Isaac and Jacob, fellow heirs of that same promise. For he was looking for a city which has foundations, whose architect and builder is God. By faith, even Sarah herself received ability to conceive even beyond the proper time of life, since she considered him faithful who had promised. Therefore, also, there was born of one man, and him as good as dead, as many descendants as the stars of heaven in number, and innumerable as the sand which is by the seashore. All these died in faith, without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of the country from which they went out, they would have had opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be their God or to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. That takes us to verse 17. By faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who received the promises was offering up his only begotten son. Okay, now we got to talk about that at some great length this morning. First off, this once again helps clarify what promise we're talking about, because he said, by faith, Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac, and he who had received the promises. That's Abraham. So we're talking about the promises made to Abraham. So we're talking about the Abrahamic covenant. There's no other possible promise that we could be talking about. We're talking about the Abrahamic covenant and the land promise that is part and parcel of that covenant. But as you know, when God first spoke to Abram and said, you're going to be a father of nations, and there's going to be many nations come out of you. You're going to have descendants like the sands of the sea or as the stars of the heavens. And he said, walk, and everywhere your foot touches, I'm going to give you this land. Took him up on a mountain as far as you can see off in the distance. I'm going to give you all this land. And I'm going to give it to you and your descendants, which is what seed means. I'm going to give it to you and your descendants forever. It's going to be yours as an eternal inheritance. This all belongs to you. And of course, he didn't inherit any of it in his lifetime. By faith, he embraced the promise afar off. But even as God was saying, this is all going to belong to you and your descendants, he had no kids. Slight problem. And so God promised him that he and his wife Sarah were going to have a child, and through that child, all these promises were going to come true. The way that it's spelled out is, in Isaac shall your seed be called. In other words, the descendants, leading ultimately to the Christ, are going to go through Isaac. Initially, when Abram talked to God about it, he said, all I've got is Eliezer. He's the head of my household. He's the one that's going to inherit everything. I assume we're talking about Eliezer, right? God says, no, it's going to be someone from your own loins. You're going to have your own child. And then time goes by. Lots of time goes by. They decide maybe God didn't mean it exactly the way he said it. Maybe he sort of kind of meant it and then left it up to us to work it out on our own. And so then Abram ends up in the tent with Hagar and produces a child, a boy. Abram's thrilled. Okay, I finally got a boy. Boy named Ishmael. He goes before God and says, oh, that Ishmael could be before me forever. God says, nope, it's not him. You're going to have a child with your wife, who, by the way, is too old to have children at this point. But it's still going to be with her. She hears that, though she's hiding behind a tent door, and she laughs. And then God confronts her about it and says, why did you laugh? And then she lies. She says, I did not laugh. As if you could lie to God. And the angel of the Lord says, oh, but you did laugh. And then she goes, yeah, okay. You won't find the phrase, yeah, okay. But she kind of had to be cornered about it. So when Isaac is born, he's named Itzhak. If you've heard of the violinist Itzhak Perlman, okay, well, that's just the original Hebrew name that has been anglicized to Isaac. And it means laughter. Laughter Perlman, playing the fiddle. And he'd be deeply offended that I referred to it as a fiddle. Yeah. Isaac, whose name is Laughter, is now the promised child, miraculously given to Abraham and Sarah, though they're too old to have kids, which is why the writer of Hebrews said, and out of him, and he's as good as dead. And yet there sprang all these children. And now God says to Abram, hey, you know that kid? That promised kid? That one and only kid? You know that one? Yeah, kill him. Now, this is a huge problem, because not only is this human sacrifice something that God strictly forbids, but it also means that the child through whom all these promises are going to flow, in Isaac shall thy seed be called, God says, kill that child. The writer of Hebrews uses a very specific word here and says, By faith, when Abram was tested, he offered up Isaac. That's not the word that is tempting in order to make someone fall. This word is a testing that is specifically for the purpose of testing Abraham's faith. Not testing it to see if it's there, but testing it to add metal to it. And in fact, it's a phrase that is used sometimes in metallurgy, that they'll test the metal. Have you heard that phrase? And basically what it means is they're checking to make sure that it has all the tensile strength that it's supposed to have. Well, that's the word. In other words, God takes Abraham through a situation where Abraham's just been getting things. God's just giving him things. God's made him wealthy. God puts him into a land. God's, when he goes and fights against the kings of the plains, Sodom and Gomorrah, God gives him the victory. Now God's given him a son. God just keeps giving Abraham stuff, and now he's going to test Abraham's mettle, test his faith in order to perfect that faith. So he goes for the most difficult test he can find and says to Abraham, kill the kid. And the question is, would Abraham do it? And what would he learn about God in the process? Turn to Genesis 22. Keep your finger in Hebrews. We may or may not be back. Genesis 22. The writer of Hebrews, of course, assumes that his Israelite audience to whom he's writing knows this whole story, which is why he can just reference it in shorthand and then move on. Because he knows that his audience knows the story in detail, so he can just mention it and go on. But we, 21st century Gentiles, especially within the 21st century Gentile church, boy, if we're lacking anywhere, it's lacking in understanding Old Testament scripture. For some reason, there have always been movements within the Gentile church that emphasize the New Testament to the exclusion of the Old. And what we have to understand is that the New Testament is written on the basis of the Old, and that the New Testament authors, with the exception of Luke, are all Hebrews. They are all Israelites, and so they're making reference constantly back into the Old Testament. And you can't make the transition from Malachi to Matthew. You know, if you just start right at Matthew, okay, I'm going to read the New Testament. Matthew 1:1, here we go. What you immediately bump into is all these Hebraisms and all these references to Old Testament prophets and genealogies through all of these Old Testament people. Matthew is the most Jewish of all of the four Gospels. And yet it's just organizationally the first book in the New Testament. So if you start reading there, you're not going to be able to understand it if you have no background in the Old Testament. And by the way, Matthew quotes from the Old Testament more than any of the other three Gospels. So you have to have grounding in the Old Testament in order to understand the theology that the New Testament writers are supporting. By the way, you know, we as Calvinistic or Reformed or Sovereign Grace people, we very often point back to Pauline theology, because certainly, you know, Romans 8 and 9 and 10, you know, there's real solid election language there. Ephesians 1 from the pen of Paul that Shane read last week, it's all that predestinary language and God's election and God doing everything according to the counsel of his own will. And certainly when you're reading through Paul's language, writing to the Thessalonians and saying that he thanks God for them because God chose them before the foundation of the world for salvation. You know, I mean, it's really Paul who grounds us in that kind of election predestinary language that lays at the heart of Reformed theology, except that every proof text Paul offers to support that theology, he finds in the Old Testament. And for those of you who have been keeping up with our Wednesday night studies, I'm sure you would agree that we find all of that theology. We find it in Moses. We find it in the first five books of the Bible. It's not difficult. As soon as you get Samuel being told by God to go into the house of Jesse and anoint the next king, and it turns out to be David who's not even in the room, I mean, there's election. That's not even hard to find. So we have to know our Old Testament in order to understand the New Testament, and this is one of the places where that is particularly true. Okay, I've talked that long in order to give everybody a chance to get to Genesis 22. Everybody there? You're without excuse at this point. We're plowing forward. Genesis 22, starting at verse 1. It came about after these things. That's after all the other situations, in particular a situation that arises back in chapter 21. In fact, let's look at that. Chapter 21, starting at verse, I'm so sorry to do this to you. Starting at verse 9. Sarah, starting in verse 9 of chapter 21 of Genesis. Now Sarah saw the son of Hagar the Egyptian, whom she had borne to Abraham, and saw him mocking. Therefore she said to Abraham, "Drive out this maid and her son, for the son of this maid shall not be an heir with my son Isaac." And the matter distressed Abraham greatly because he loved his son. He's got two boys. He loves them both. He doesn't want to tell one of them, get out. But God said to Abraham, and this is very important, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and the maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her." By the way, for all the women in the room, it's one of the moments where God says to a man, listen to your wife. Just use it later. That's all I'm saying. Just trying to help. That's all I'm doing. Just up here making friends. That's all I'm doing. God said to Abraham, "Do not be distressed because of the lad and your maid. Whatever Sarah tells you, listen to her. For through Isaac your descendants shall be named." That's where you find, "In Isaac shall thy seed be called." This is the specific moment when God says you have two sons, an older and a younger. The older is not going to receive the promise, the inheritance, the right of the firstborn is not going to go to the firstborn. It's going to go to the secondborn, Isaac, the son of promise, and in Isaac shall your seed be called. And of course, you know that in the book of Galatians, Paul picks up that entire scenario and says that this is God's way of saying that that firstborn who is a child of bondage, because the mother was a bondservant, and so that first child is driven out in favor of the child of promise who is born to a free woman. And then Paul says, and we are children of the free woman. We're not children of the bondwoman, so that God was typologically saying, drive out the bondwoman and her child. Don't be entangled again with the yoke of bondage. You're children of the free. So Paul sees a tremendous amount of theology in that exchange right there. But I wanted you to see it because it says, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. And in the next verse in the book of Hebrews, that's going to be quoted. So I wanted you to see where it came from. Chapter 22, verse 1. Now we're plowing forward. Now it came about after these things that God tested Abraham and said to him, Abraham, and he said, here I am. Notice that the writer of Hebrews picked up that very concept and said, God tested Abraham. Where'd he get that? From the text. All he did was pick it up from the text, import it into the New Testament, and say, this is what the text says. And he said, take now your son, your only son. Isn't that interesting language? Because Abraham actually has two sons. But back here, God said, drive out the son of bondage, send away the bondservant. In Isaac your seed shall be called. And from that point forward, God's interest was in Isaac because the seed is going to ultimately lead to Christ. And that is God's primary interest in this continual genealogy throughout the Old Testament. The reason that there are books in the Old Testament like Numbers, which is a book full of numbers. And it's a number of people, this many in this tribe, this many in this tribe, there's that many in this tribe, and he begat, and they begat, and these others begat, and there was a lot of begatting going on. But the whole point of the genealogies, if you pay attention to them, and as they continue through the Chronicles, and as they continue, and then are picked up in Luke and are picked up in Matthew, the whole purpose behind those chronologies and those genealogies is to show the continuation of the seed from Abraham to Christ. So God, with that intention in mind, says it's through this son that the seed is going to be counted. Through this son, the Christ is going to come. So follow that seed. Really hang on to that because it's going to be important in the next couple of weeks. Because as the writer of Hebrews decides which notable characters to mention, he's always going to mention the ones who are within that seed lineage leading to Christ, so that it's through the seed of Jacob that the Christ is going to come. The interest is always in keeping track of the seed pointing to Christ. So now take your son, your only son, in other words, the only one that matters. God, by the way, does say to Abraham, don't worry about Ishmael. He's going to be fine. He's going to have 12 princes. 12 nations are going to come out of him because he is your son. So he's going to get like the trickle-down effect of being Abraham's son. But you don't see anywhere in the Bible the continual genealogy of Ishmael. The Ishmaelites, by the way, become what we now know as the Arab people, as do the children of Esau, the Esauites. They become enemies of the children of God and of the seed and of Israel. So he said, take now your son, your only son, whom you love, Isaac, go to the land of Moriah, offer him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains of which I will tell you. This is very much like how God met him in Ur of the Chaldees and said, take your family, take your wife, take your servants, take everything and just go. I'll tell you when you get there. And Abraham, in faith, did that. Now God says, okay, this time, take your son, head toward Moriah, just go. I'll let you know when you get there. All Abram knows is, I'm on my way to some specific place that God is going to show me. It's some specific mountain that he's going to point out to me. And when I get there, I'm going to kill and burn my son. My only son. I used to have two sons. Then God made me get rid of the older son. I obediently got rid of the older son. And now God wants me to kill the younger son. And I waited 20 years for this kid. And he's a child of promise. But he did it. He followed through with what God said to do. So Abraham rose early in the morning, saddled his donkey, took two of his young men with him, and Isaac his son, and he split wood for a burnt offering, and arose and went to the place of which God had told him. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes, saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said, get this, as he could see it in the distance, Moriah, okay, we're going to go in there. There's going to be some hill. God is going to tell us which hill it is he wants the child to be sacrificed on. He says to the young men, the servants that are with him, you stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go yonder and we will worship. They don't know that this worship is going to include, I'm going to kill this boy and I'm going to burn the boy. I just didn't mention that part. But we're going to go do that because that's what God requires. And then look at the next phrase. And we will return to you. What? Okay, so apparently Abraham had so much confidence in God's promise, in Isaac shall thy seed be called. Once God said, through Isaac, your descendants are going to be as numerous as the stars of the heaven, sands of the sea. It's going to all happen through Isaac. It's not going to happen through Ishmael. It's definitely happening through Isaac. And so even if God says, take the boy up there, kill him, burn him, Abraham says, and you know what? We'll be back. Because somehow God is going to work this out. Somehow, even if he has to raise him from the dead, he's going to bring him back. Now, the writer of Hebrews is going to tell us that in a symbol, that's what happened, that he received him back as from the dead. The word that the writer of Hebrews is going to use, and this is important, see if you can figure out this Greek word. Anyone?
Parable.
Parable. It's parabole in Greek. But you take that O out of there, you've got the word parable. Now, this is a form of which is the word that is translated parable when Jesus tells parables. When Jesus would tell a parable, he would take something common, familiar, and then he would compare it to something unfamiliar so that you could understand the unfamiliar thing. However, Jesus also used parables for the specific reason or the specific purpose of hiding knowledge as well. He spoke to them in parables so that they would not understand and would not believe and he would heal their sicknesses and all that. And so parables had a dual purpose. Sometimes they would reveal something that had been hidden. Sometimes they would hide things to keep them from being revealed. And Jesus used parables all the time. Well, the writer of Hebrews picks up this form of the word, parabole, and says that Abraham received his son back like a resurrection, like from the dead. And he received him back, your translations will say, in a type or in a form. I think they should have just said, in a parable, because that's what this whole story is. Now we know that the writer of Hebrews understands that the story we're reading is a form of a parable designed to teach us something. It's designed to reveal something to us. On the third day, Abraham raised his eyes, and he saw the place from a distance. And Abraham said to his young men, "Stay here with the donkey. I and the lad will go yonder, and we will worship and return to you." And Abraham took the wood of the burnt offering, laid it on Isaac his son, and he took in his hand the fire and the knife. So the two of them walked on together. In other words, he had some sort of a container in which he kept fire, some kind of a lantern in which there was fire. He had wood, and he has the knife to kill the child, and he has the kid. Then he makes Isaac carry the wood that he's going to be burned on. As a result of this image of Isaac carrying the wood on his back, it's very common to hear people say then that Isaac is a type of Christ because he's carrying the sacrificial wood on his back and he's going to be made a sacrifice. There is a type of Christ in this story. I just don't think it's Isaac. Now, some commentators will say that Isaac is the type of Christ right up until the sacrifice is withheld. And then, of course, you're going to hear about the ram caught in a thicket who does become the sacrifice. And so they say, well, it's two different images of Christ, one as the willing sacrifice and then one as the actual substitute. When we get to the end and you see all the images together, I think Isaac is a type of you and I, or at very least, Israel, since he has the promises and the seed within himself. Because he ends up with judgment about to come down on him, and he has a fire underneath him. So fire below, judgment above, and at the very moment when it looks like his life is going to be turned over to judgment and fire, a substitute is found. That's Christ in the story, at least to my way of thinking. Now, if you hold to a separate interpretation and you want to say that there is a Christ-like figure to be had in Isaac carrying the wood and being a willing sacrifice, okay, but I prefer to see the dramatic substitution in the story. And like I said, there is a type of Christ, and it's just as bold and obvious as it can be. Verse 7. Isaac spoke to Abraham, his father, and said, "My father." And he said, "Here I am, my son. There's only two of us walking now. I'd be the other guy. I'm right here." And he said, I'm sorry, I'm reading between the lines again, aren't I? And he said, "Behold, the fire and the wood, but where is the lamb for the burnt offering?" Isaac still doesn't know he's the offering. So where is a lamb for a burnt offering? Now, the next phrase is very interesting, and it's just as interesting in the Hebrew as it is in the English, because there's an interesting little ambiguity in it. Abraham said, "God will provide." Now, in some of your translations, it'll say, "He will provide for himself." The "for" is additional. If you read it in the Hebrew, it's more cryptic. It's, "God will provide himself a lamb." In other words, it can be read, God will provide a lamb for himself, which is why we didn't bring one. God's going to provide one. But it can also just as easily be read, God himself is the Lamb. Now that's really interesting, because we know that when you get to like the book of Revelation, Jesus is presented full-fledged as the Lamb of God, but he's also referred to during his earthly ministry as the Lamb of God, and yet he is God incarnate. And so in reality, when Christ was on the planet, God provided himself as God, as a lamb, as a substitute. And that is prefigured in this phrase. Abraham said, God will provide himself a lamb for a burnt offering, my son. So the two of them walked on together. Then they came to the place of which God had told him, and Abraham built an altar there, and he arranged the wood. And then he tied up his son Isaac. Had to be a surprise. Isaac's thinking, there'll be a lamb up there, and then Dad starts tying him down. He arranged the wood, he bound his son Isaac, and he laid him on the altar on top of the wood. And Abraham stretched out his hand and took the knife to slay his son. So there's the image. He's bound, he's tied up, fire underneath, judgment above, knife about to kill him. And he even raised the knife. Just put flesh and blood on it for a moment. Because there have been times, moments in my life that I've wanted to kill my kids. But, oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry, were you in the room? When I'm sorry.
I think you should say those minds kind of stuff in your head.
Say that with my inside voice in the future? But really, put flesh and blood on it. It's my beloved kid. It's the child of promise. It's the only child I've had with my wife, Sarah. It's miraculous. She was too old to have a child. We even named him Laughter, gave him this great name. And now I've got him laying on the sticks. I've got the fire at the ready. I've got the knife in my hand, and I'm raising it back, getting ready to plunge the knife into him to kill him as a sacrifice, because God said to, don't take it lightly that Abraham did these things. Don't just think, well, that was some guy in a desert 4,000 years ago, and who knows? I mean, really think about whether you would be able, whether your faith in God would be strong enough that if God told you to do this, you'd be willing to stand in that position where Abraham was. But this, again, is why he is the father of the faithful. He had such faith in God that he told the servants, we're going to go up there, and he knew full well what he was going up there to do. We're going up there, and we're going to worship. I'm going to sacrifice to God, and then me and the boy, we're coming back. And yet he was so confident that God was going to bring the boy back that he was willing to plunge the knife into the boy. It's astounding. Can you see now why the writer of Hebrews would want to pick that up and say, and oh yeah, this was faith. It's a perfect example of faith. He was doing what God said to do. So he raised the knife to slay his son, but the angel of the Lord called to him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here I am. I'm right here, knife in hand, my son on the altar, fire at the ready. He's laying on the wood. I'm ready to kill him. I'm right here. What do you want? Do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. It was all a test. It was all a test of Abraham's faith. And Abraham passed the test. But in the midst of passing the test, he had full confidence that no matter what he did up there on that mountain, God was still going to give the boy back to him, because he'd already given him the boy once. He'd already given him the boy miraculously. He'd already, for lack of a better term, brought Sarah's womb back to life from the dead in order to bring the boy about in the first place. And by the way, this is the first place in the Bible where you even find the language or the expectation of resurrection. You read nothing about resurrection or life from the dead, physical dead, until this moment. And yet Abraham had full confidence that no matter what happened up there on that hill in Moriah, the boy was going to be alive when it was all over, because God had said, in Isaac your seed's going to be called. Isaac is going to have children. And through Isaac's children, this land is going to be inherited. And that's a promise from God. And so Abraham did everything else God told him to do, even though it seemed counterintuitive. Go kill the boy who has the promise? And he went and did it. Now look at this. This is amazing. Don't stretch your hand out against the lad. Do nothing to him. For now I know that you fear God, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him, a ram caught in a thicket by his horns. That's very specific. That's a lot of specification there. So you've got a ram with horns, because he's caught by his horns. And where's he caught? He's in a thicket, a thorny bush. A ram with his head in thorns. What were the chances? And by the way, apparently not there when they went up. Because on the way up, he said, God's going to provide himself a lamb. They get there. Abraham looks around. Nothing. Ties up his boy. Puts him on the wood. Raises the knife. Not until God speaks and says, wait, don't do it. Then he sees the ram caught in the thicket. And the ram caught in the thicket becomes the substitute for Isaac. And because, get this, this is really big. If you catch nothing else I've said this morning, follow this. The seed is going through Isaac. And the ram was the substitute for Isaac and the seed. This is just not a random person that he was a substitute for. The ram was a substitute for Isaac and the seed of Abraham. There's no way around that. So here's what happens. Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. And Abraham went and took the ram and offered him up for a burnt offering in the place of his son. And this is the sixth recitation of the Abrahamic covenant promise. A couple of weeks ago, we read seven recitations of it. And Abraham called the name of the place, the Lord will provide. And it's called that to this day. In the mount of the Lord, it will be provided. Then the angel of the Lord called to Abraham a second time from heaven and said, by myself I have sworn, declares the Lord, because you have done this thing and have not withheld your son, your only son, indeed I will greatly bless you, and I will greatly multiply your seed as the stars of the heavens and as the sand which is on the seashore, and your seed shall possess the gate of their enemies. And in your seed all the nations of the earth shall be blessed because you have obeyed my voice. So Abraham returned to his young men, and they arose and went together to Beersheba, and Abram lived in Beersheba. Now go back to the book of Hebrews. We'll read the writer of Hebrews' commentary on everything we just read. Hebrews 11, starting in verse 17. By faith Abraham, when he was tested, offered up Isaac. And he who had received the promises, Abraham, was offering up his only begotten son, who the writer of Hebrews has already told us, shares in those same promises. It was he to whom it was said, in Isaac shall your descendants be called. That's Genesis 21:12. We just looked at it. Verse 19, now here's his commentary on that. Because he, Abraham, considered that God is able to raise even from the dead, from which he also received Isaac back as a type, as a parabole. So Abraham did receive his son back from the dead because the sentence of God was on him. The sentence of God was kill the child. And then he received him back from the dead, but how did he get him back from the dead? Through a substitute. And he did all of that by faith. That's the point. And so from there, the writer of Hebrews is going to say, then by faith, Isaac, who we just heard about being raised from the dead, and he's going to talk about Isaac passing down that birthright blessing to the next generations, and that's what we're going to look at next week. And he's going to continue to trace the seed, and he's going to continue to trace the promise, and he's going to continue to show how each of these individuals did what they did by faith in God. The encouragement to the original audience then, and to us, is that in this lifetime, God is going to be true to his word. God is going to be faithful to his word. Whatever God says, he's going to do it. And when you go through your trials in life, when you go through your testing in life, God will put you in situations where faith is required. But he's not doing it for the purpose of causing you to fall. He's not doing it for the purpose of undermining you. He's doing it for the purpose of building up your faith. Here, I'll put it this way. Anybody here ever gone through a hard time? Hey, that was easy, wasn't it? Everybody but Shane raised their hand. Apparently Shane's just having a blessed life right now, and everything's going easy for Shane. It's just smooth skating and downhill sledding for Shane.
He's married to Elizabeth.
There. How'd you like that? So, anybody here ever had periods of time when everything went pretty good in your life? Everything's just going good. Everything's fine. Everything's good. Sure. In this life, you're going to have times when you're just kind of skating along, everything's good, and you're going to have times when there's really trouble and trial. So now here's the question. Did you learn more about God through the times when it was easy or through the times when it was hard? Hard. Everybody knows. Everybody nods. Everybody goes, yeah, that's right, the hard times. When did you have to exhibit and exercise more faith? When it was good? Or when it was hard? Well, when it was hard. When it's good, you're usually not going to exercise a whole lot of faith. If anything, you're just going to be grateful and thankful, and it's going good, and thanks God, I'll take another one of these tomorrow. Thanks. It's all good. I'm appreciating it. But when the struggle comes, when the trial comes, when the difficulty comes, it's not going to overwhelm you. It's not going to destroy you. Because it's not for that purpose. It's for the purpose of testing your mettle. It's for the purpose of building up your faith. It's for the purpose of driving you to your knees and causing you to rest entirely in God for the outcome. That's what Abraham did. The outcome was completely up to God. God said, do this. What God told him to do seemed counterintuitive. He did it anyway because that's what God said to do, and he trusted God with the outcome. As a result, we're still talking about it 4,000 years later and still pointing at it. And the writers of the New Testament are still saying, he's the father of faith. He's the example of faith. And therefore, we're called to demonstrate a similar faith, to follow in the footsteps of Abraham, who way back then did what God told him to do and as a consequence received his son back in a type, in a parable. But in receiving his son back, it showed yet again not only the faithfulness of God, but it prefigured the substitutionary work of Christ. So not only did God reward his faith by giving him back his son, but God rewards his faith by giving him righteousness. And you just don't find a better deal than that. But that's carried all the way into the New Testament as our example of faith. So when you go through your struggle, when you go through your trial, which you're going to do, it's just part of human life. When you got your I'm a human license, trouble just came as part of the package. You're going to go through your struggle in life. And when you do, you're going to look to God because, as Paul writes, there is no trial taken you, but such as is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not let you be tempted beyond what you're able to bear. That's good to know. That means God knows exactly how much I'm able to bear, and he's not going to test me beyond what I'm able to bear. Sometimes it feels like it. Sometimes it feels like God has gone beyond my limits. But he's not going to test you beyond what you're able to bear, but will, with the temptation, provide a way of escape so that you'll be able to bear it. It's exactly what Paul writes. So next time you're in your struggle, in your trial, do two things. Look up, be faithful, do what God says, and at the same time, look for the way of escape, because it's there somewhere. He will provide a way of escape, and if you know that's there, you'll be able to bear it. You'll get through it. You'll get to the other side. And then remember, because in this context I always have to add, and then remember that all God has ever promised you for today is food and raiment. Something to eat, something to wear. There are no naked or starving people in this room. And I am grateful for that fact. Not the starving part. Just glad you didn't show up naked. He promised you every single day food and raiment, food and raiment, food and raiment. Everything else is grace. Everything else is above and beyond. But if you have something to eat and something to wear today, God was faithful to you yet again today. So count faithfulness appropriately. Don't think that just because you've lost some of the creature comforts and accoutrements that you became used to, don't think that just because you lost those that God is being faithless. As long as he has given you something to eat and something to wear, he's been faithful to you, tell him thank you. And then look around at all the other stuff he gave you and be really, really thankful. And then the next time the trial comes, recognize it for what it is. It's God improving you. It's God molding you into the person he's going to make you into. And he's going to cause you to look to him in faith. And then he's going to give you righteousness in exchange for that faith. And then you stand before him, spotless, unblemished, perfected forever, and get to spend eternity in his presence through this process. So recognize the process for what it is. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yes.
Some churches say, amen? Amen. No, here we go. Yeah? I don't know what that's about. I have no idea what that's about. You have any questions about that? We're good? Glad to hear it. Say goodbye to the internet, folk.
Bye, friends. Bye.
We thank you for joining us for this Salvation by Grace message. For more information, please visit our website at salvationbygrace.org. And join us next time as we gather around the Word and study the sovereign grace of God.